you. We're going to go on to case number 2. That is 10-1418, O'Leary versus Accretive Health.
Good morning, Judge Roebner. I'm Nancy Temple, counsel for plaintiff appellant Joseph O'Leary. O'Leary was a former senior executive of defendant Accretive Health, fired January 2, 2007. He filed retaliation claims under Title VII and Section 1981. The district court judge granted summary judgment for Accretive on January 19, 2010. We're here because there were genuine issues of disputed material facts, and we believe Mr. O'Leary is entitled to a jury trial. He opposed the conduct of a mid-level supervisor, Rhonda Miller, that he believed was racially discriminatory and also involved sexual harassment.
You know, we know that Mr. O'Leary raised Ms. Miller's remarks at the dinner with Ms. Tolan. But when he was asked at his deposition whether he raised any other complaints about her, or I suppose I should say about her behavior, he said none. So in terms of opposition to sexual harassment, aren't we confined to the remarks at the dinner alone?
No, Judge. Here's the record. Before the October 23rd discussion with Tolan, O'Leary was told to him that Miller had made these comments at the dinner. There's also evidence in the record from Shannon Cooper that Miller made similar sexually inappropriate comments that were more graphic in nature, more sexually explicit on at least 10 other occasions. And O'Leary testified that Cooper told him that. So he did have a good faith basis beyond just one particular remark at a dinner. He also testified he was concerned, and this is reported in Stan Telford's October 26, 2006 investigative report as well, that Stan says that I talked to O'Leary and he's concerned about, expressed additional concern about Rhonda's behavior in the past, and he was not surprised by the statements that were reported to him about the October 6 dinner. O'Leary also testified he was concerned about Rhonda Miller's comments at the dinner and their impact not only on Blake Graves, the 23-year-old that she directed the 23-year-old comment to, but also on her other subordinates that she invited to the dinner, including Celine Nichols. Those were never investigated by the company. Telford, the HR director, never interviewed Nichols or Cooper or even Miller herself, and there was evidence that another 23-year-old young man, Nick Murkus, also a subordinate, was at that dinner. He never bothered to interview those persons. There's a question about the scope of the investigation here. And as the court has recognized before in the Seabox versus Humphreys case, the Cracker Barrel case, when Cracker Barrel took and credited the statement of one employee and did not investigate that statement, that raised a question of fact and inference as to the intent in firing the plaintiff, the African-American plaintiff there. So there are questions about the investigation. O'Leary knew more than just the October 6, 2006 dinner when he met with Tolan on the 23rd with respect to sexual harassment. And it wasn't just October 23rd that he raised his concerns. He reported to Tolan. Tolan was his boss, and so was Etienne Defarge, the number two person in the company. He continued to raise concerns about the scope of the investigation to the HR director, to Defarge, and to Tolan, and concerns about Miller's conduct after that singular meeting on October 23rd.
Now, Judge Cohen said that Mr. O'Leary provided no evidence or no evidentiary support for the contention that he also opposed racial discrimination by Ms. Miller. So what is the evidence?
Yes, Judge.
Mr. O'Leary expressed a concern that she might you know, also be a racist, basically, or, you know, practicing racial discrimination.
All right. I'll divide it between what was known before October 23rd and then the testimony after that. Before October 23rd, O'Leary testified at his deposition that he personally observed Miller berate Slee Nichols in a public setting, unjustifiably, and that he scolded Miller for that conduct. He also testified that before October 23rd, Miller complained to him about the performance of three African-American women, Nichols, Kathy White, and Judith Holmes. O'Leary said he followed up and found that these were good performers. There was no basis to Miller's complaints, and he was concerned about her calling out and singling out African-American women when she was not doing it with a white employee that reported to her, Shannon Cooper.
But doesn't the evidence seem to show that Ms. Miller is the kind of person, sort of an equal opportunity discriminator, and berates everyone in her path? And she certainly, you know, seems like a difficult person toward the world in general.
That's the Acreta's theory, that the district court weighed the evidence improperly and credited that theory. O'Leary's contrary evidence is that Nichols and Holmes' declarations say that Cooper, the white employee, was not treated the same way they were. O'Leary observed that Cooper was not treated the same way. And the evidence is that the four African-American females who reported to Miller, Nichols, Holmes, Pinkston, and White, were all fired. Cooper still works there, the white woman. So if you credit O'Leary's testimony, and we cited his deposition testimony in this Rule 56.1 statement, paragraphs 59 to 64, he specifically testified, and we quoted the question and answer in the brief because we thought this was significant, that I told Tolan on the 23rd I thought Miller was riding Nichols hard and that it was racially motivated discipline. Now, what happened after the 23rd? On the 26th, Miller fired Slee Nichols. And when O'Leary found out about this, he didn't trust Miller's explanation. He called up Celine and said, "Celine, what happened?" And O'Leary testified at his deposition, also cited to the district court in the statement of facts, that Nichols told him she was considering an EEOC charge, that Miller drove her and fired her, drove her out of the company, fired her. That's a racial discriminatory treatment, firing somebody based on race. That's what Nichols said she believed. O'Leary testified that he raised this with the HR director, Telford, and Telford said, well, Nichols did not mention an EOC claim in her exit interview, so I'm not concerned. HR never followed up. O'Leary wrote an email on November 13, 2006. This is deposition exhibit number 6 to his deposition in the record. He wrote it to ATM DeFarge saying, "I raised these issues about Celine being fired by Miller and being driven out of the company. I'm concerned about a hostile work environment claim, about future exposure to the company, and that we haven't investigated this properly." The HR director blew it off, essentially. DeFarge never followed up. And DeFarge was one of the decision makers about the firing of O'Leary. O'Leary also testified in his deposition that he raised the concerns about Miller firing Nichols directly to Tolan. Now, he didn't say the particular date that he told her that, but he reported to Tolan. Tolan was his boss. He interacted with her on a regular basis. We have to credit, in this swearing contest, we have to credit O'Leary's deposition testimony as compared to Tolan's at this point in time.
But if I recall the briefs correctly, Accretive noted that in his emails and his memos, regarding the complaint that he made to Tolan, he didn't say anything about race. Is that incorrect?
There was one email that he sent to Tolan regarding the October 23rd meeting, and it's true that email does not mention race. But he testified that he raised concerns about Miller generally and the way she was treating the employees. And you have to credit that. Nichols was fired.
But if it's all employees, you know, that's what I'm trying to zone in on.
He testified that he was concerned specifically about how Miller was treating African-American Slee Nichols in racially motivated discipline on October 23rd with Tolan. October 26th, Nichols was fired, and O'Leary testified that when he found out the circumstances of her being fired, he raised concerns to Tolan, to DeFarge, HR Director Stan Telford, and to Steve Smith, another senior VP, about Miller driving Nichols out of the company and possible exposure to a claim by Celine Nichols against Accretive.
I want to be sure I understand the theory of your case. Are you saying O'Leary is essentially a whistleblower?
Yes.
He's fired as a whistleblower?
He's fired in retaliation for opposing what he believed to be the racially discriminatory conduct of Rhonda Miller and the sexual harassment comments that he reported as well. Yes.
Why would they fire him for that? I mean, what's in it for them?
Miller was very highly valued employee in the company. You look at her personnel evaluations, she was highly touted.
Weren't all these people, all these customers dissatisfied with him? I mean,
no. Tolan testified that she made her decision to fire him for two reasons. Her stated reasons were poor financial performance and complaints by three CFO customers, Cuton, Felbinger, and Chalk. Cuton and Felbinger submitted declarations denying making any negative statements or comments about O'Leary's performance or suggesting that he should be terminated.
Off one account, wasn't it? You don't dispute that they took him off an account, one of these accounts that supposedly complained.
That's correct. St. Mary's, Perry Chalk was the CFO there.
So why would they take him off the account if he was so good?
For reasons that we explain in the record. Because Gary Chalk was concerned about Accretive overcharging him with a calculation they called best possible. O'Leary was not responsible for best possible. Accretive filed a patent application on best possible. It was a startup company. It was an evolving model. O'Leary was not one of the inventors. And under the Reeves Supreme Court case versus Sanderson, the employee there raised evidence that indicated the employee was not responsible for disciplining employees who showed up late. That's exactly what O'Leary did here. He showed that he was not on the best possible team. He was not an architect of best possible like Steve Smith was. And when Chalk raised concerns about best possible, you're asking me to pay $1 million on a calculation that's overstated by $2.5 million. I'm not going to do it, and he was concerned about that. So Accretive appeased it by bringing one of the architects of Best Possible into back to Greater Michigan at St. Mary's, Steve Smith. It just so happens that Smith was kicked out of his client at that point in late 06 and needed something to do. His client, CHI.
But doesn't that undermine your retaliation claim if he's transferred off there for something else?
Accretive asked him to continue to work at the other hospitals. The reason it doesn't undermine the retaliation claim, it explains that and calls into question the honesty of Tolan's stated reason for firing O'Leary. There's no evidence other than her oral testimony and DeFarge's testimony that Chalk asked that O'Leary be removed. In fact, the email chain that the district court relies upon, October 2006, from Gary Chalk with O'Leary on it, it's attached to Travis Marr's declaration. If you look at the whole email chain, Marr says, I talked to Chalk. He's not hostile at all. He's concerned about the best possible calculation. Even Chalk's email, October 7, 2006, says, I want O'Leary in here. I want Travis Marr in here. I want Mary Tolan in here. I want Steve Smith in here. I want to find out what's going on. If he wanted O'Leary off the account, he never would have asked O'Leary to come in and talk about Best Possible. And that email deals only with Best Possible. He wasn't concerned about O'Leary's personal performance whatsoever. But O'Leary was opposing Miller's conduct. Miller was getting results, and the company turned a blind eye and did not want to...
Well, is there any direct evidence that his firing was the result of his comments about Miller and...
Under the direct method?
That side of things rather than the... There seems to be some trail of evidence about whether he was doing a good job with the customers, but I don't see that. Is there a trail on the other side?
Yes. Under the direct method, there's circumstantial evidence. Under Rudin versus Lincoln Land Community, you consider...
Well,
the
circumstantial evidence is that they didn't do anything about Miller, but they did... do something about O'Leary. And you're putting those two things together.
Yes, they fired O'Leary to intimidate him from speaking up and opposing, and it's a circumstantial evidence of the pretext.
Yeah, but what's the causal link between those two things?
A causal link can be established by pretext and by similarly situated employees being treated differently, which Steve Smith, exactly same position, knew the same stuff, never opposed Miller's conduct, is still there.
You know, you're way into your rebuttal, and I'm going to give you an extra minute or whatever, because I need something cleared up. Did the plaintiff get 10 or 13 depositions?
The plaintiff got 13 depositions by agreement. We tried to substitute and drop one witness and exchange it for Gary Chuck, whom we had subpoenaed, and Accretive objected to that. We filed a motion. We're not appealing the 10-limit deposition issue at this point.
I know. I was just, you know, because I was looking at your footnote on 25, footnote 14, you know, that you had noticed Chalk's deposition.
Yes, we subpoenaed him.
Accretive objective, and Judge Conlon denied the request beyond the 10 deposition limit. But you did get 13.
Yes.
Okay. Thank you. Okay, Ms. Weiss.
Good morning, Your Honors. Brenda Feist for the defendant, appellee, Accretive Health. Your Honors, the threshold inquiry in any retaliation claim under either the direct or the indirect method is whether the plaintiff has engaged in protected activity. And under the Supreme Court's decision in Breeden, the test is very clear that it's whether the employee reasonably believes he has engaged in any protected activity, whether he has complained of unlawful conduct.
Well, suppose that an employee observes one instance of sexually harassing conduct, but he doesn't know, you know, whether it's an isolated incident or if it's a part of a pattern. So he goes to his employer, he expresses his concern, he suggests an investigation. Is it your interpretation of Breeden that he's not protected under Title VII unless he believes or the evidence shows that the incident is part of a pattern that would support a hostile environment claim?
Yes, Your Honor. What matters is what he reasonably believes, whether it's an offensive, highly offensive conduct, and, for example, in the Jordan case out of the Fourth Circuit or the Vanport Fleece case or any of the many, many cases cited in our briefs where there was highly, highly offensive conduct that was reported. Even in those scenarios, the court says that's just not enough. And here, not only did the complainant have no reason to believe what he was complaining about at the time constituted unlawful conduct, but there's nothing that he learned that provided any pattern background as the court is hypothesizing.
But what if an employee calls for an investigation into, you know, one instance of sexually inappropriate conduct to be sure that the perpetrator isn't, you know, hasn't done more of the same? I mean, that's, you know, a prudent supervisor, I would think, would look into all of that. Why wouldn't that be protective? It seems to me that Breeden leaves that scenario unresolved.
Your Honor, I would respectfully disagree with that. I think that what matters is what does the employee believe? If evidence later is determined that he was right, but he didn't know he was right, if an employee says to his employer, you know, I think my employer made a comment about what I'm wearing, and we would all agree that's probably not enough to rise to the level of protected activity. And it is later determined that, in fact, that same supervisor has seriously molested other people, but the complainant doesn't know that at the time, that does not amount to protected activity. The employee doesn't believe it.
This is a little different. I mean, her behavior at that dinner is really disgusting.
No question about it, Your Honor.
So that's, you know, here you have a disgusting person, not someone that doesn't like your clothes. And bells would go off in someone's head, you know, if someone is willing to behave so badly. this must have, you know, maybe there's more to this fire.
Breeding requires that whether the employee's belief has to be measured against the legal standard. The legal standard for sexual harassment is whether there is unwelcome conduct, severe or pervasive unwelcome conduct. Here, while there is no doubt, and the court is absolutely correct, the conduct was very unseemly, highly inappropriate. However, whether it necessarily amounted to sexual harassment is a different question, and every indication that the complainant had, that Mr. O'Leary had, was that no one was offended by his own testimony. He said that he knew that Mr. Graves, the young man, was absolutely, and I'm quoting, absolutely didn't feel harassed.
That shows how honest Mr. O'Leary is, doesn't it? I mean, it really does show that he's a very honest person.
And his subjective belief is very important. And if that's what he honestly believed, that's very important.
Yeah, but...
Well, just because this other fellow said he wasn't offended or wasn't disturbed doesn't mean that that's a fact.
That may be, but all we can rely on is what we have a reason.
That's the obvious thing to say under the circumstances.
And the court is right. He may have said it but not really felt it, but what matters is what indicators did Mr. O'Leary have to lead to his belief? And if all of the indicators are the guy thinks it's a joke, the guy says, I don't feel harassed, the guy says, I think we're making a mountain out of a molehill here, and no one else comes forward to say they were complained. And here's a key point that's really not been stressed. Mr. O'Leary wasn't there.
A more telling point is how pervasive was this? I mean, this is one incident.
That's exactly right, Your Honor. It was one incident, certainly not a pervasive incident.
I think Judge Rovner was getting at, in part, the fact that it's one incident rather than a pattern. You know, you have to have a pattern to qualify as a case of sexual harassment.
Not necessarily. I mean, the standard is
one
severe or pervasive. Severe or pervasive. So if the conduct is highly pervasive, that might satisfy the standard for sexual harassment. If there's one incident that's very severe, I mean, we could all agree that if someone were raped, that wouldn't have to happen multiple times. That would be severe enough to happen one time. But that's not the record here.
That person would be in prison.
Certainly, Your Honor. But the record here is that there was one comment. It was one incident. It was not only was it, while highly inappropriate, not an egregious comment, no one in the environment viewed it as hostile. And that's what matters. Is it unwelcome under the legal standard for sexual harassment?
You know, these were all, if I remember correctly, and I might not be remembering correctly, you help me, but I think they were all sort of juniors. And juniors, you know, are pretty scared to say much of anything. I know it's true in my chambers.
And that may be, but again, it's unreasonable to assume that because a comment like this is made, that everybody must have been harassed. Just like it may not be fair to assume everybody wasn't harassed, it would be equally unfair to assume, without any indication to the contrary, that anybody was harassed. And what matters under Breeden is, what did he reasonably believe? He wasn't there, so he couldn't make a judgment. He can only base his judgment on what he heard from others. And not a single person at that dinner expressed being offended. All he heard from Blake Graves was that he thought it was a joke. He thought it was lighthearted. He couldn't believe this had even been escalated to management at all. So that's the one example of potential protected activity, the comment at the dinner. The other, and again, no information that anybody else, he's now shifting gears and saying, well, maybe it wasn't Graves who was offended, maybe it was Nichols, but there's no indication that Nichols was offended in any way. If we look at the comments, his alleged claim of racial treatment.
Well, was it inappropriate for him to report this incident to the other management?
Was it inappropriate? I'm sorry, Your Honor?
Inappropriate, yeah. I'm not asking was it illegal, I'm saying. Was it inappropriate?
For him to report it?
Yeah.
He's welcome to report anything he wants, but all that matters is a matter of law. Is whether it rises to the level.
It was a pretty crass incident.
Yeah. I wouldn't disagree with that, but that doesn't change the legal standard.
Just because everybody said, oh, well, I'm more independent, doesn't convince me that that is necessarily the case.
Well, I think under any, certainly under Meritor, the Supreme Court's decision in Meritor, and under any of the Seventh Circuit's decisions regarding sex harassment, that comment alone, standing alone, would not rise to the level of sexual harassment, even without any indication of how anybody reacted to it.
No, it may not, but it's a little hard to identify exactly why not.
If I could move on to the potential racial harassment, is the only other arguable protected activity he may have. And again, if he can't satisfy the threshold of protected activity, then the case is over. That is a critical element of the prima facie case under either the direct or the indirect method. The only other potential claim of protected activity he has is that he says he reported race harassment or race discrimination against Rhonda Miller, that Rhonda Miller discriminated against Celine Nichols. It is based solely on his observing Celine yelling at Celine Nichols in one meeting. First of all, there's no credible evidence that he actually complained of this at all. Whether he observed this and may have felt it is one thing. Whether he actually communicated it to management, there's no credible evidence in the record that that occurred. As the court noted, he deliberately documented his concerns about Miller both in emails and memos, and not once did he mention a concern about race. The only reference he makes to race to Nichols at all has to do with hostile environment regarding the dinner. Again, nothing to do with race. To the extent he expresses a concern that Nichols may have maybe filing an EEOC charge, the flaw in this argument is that Nichols didn't even talk about filing an EEOC charge until after she resigned. And by the way, she resigned. She was not fired. Counsel kept referring to her being fired. She resigned. Was not fired.
But didn't she resign because it had just gotten too difficult?
That's what she says, but that still doesn't raise any concern about race discrimination. There's no, at the time he made any complaint about Nichols, he had no reason to believe she was filing a charge about an EEOC charge. And, in fact, she didn't file an EEOC charge. There's no evidence in the record that she did. But chronologically, it's out of sequence.
I would like, if you don't mind, to take you into pretext.
Certainly, Your Honor. Certainly. The district.
Mr. O'Leary says he has affidavits from two of the three clients denying the critical comments that were attributed to them, or that Mr. Defarge attributed to them. Why doesn't that alone, two out of the three, when we can't get that third, Mr. Chalk, we can't get Mr. Chalk into this, why doesn't that suffice to create a factual question as to pretext?
First of all, Your Honor, Mary Tolan, the CEO, testified that it was Chalk's criticism that was really the straw that broke the camel's back. Chalk, you'll recall, was the CFO at St. Mary's, and that was the account that he was asked to be removed from. So the other two clients, Cuton and Felbinger, well, they provide some chorus, if you will, that he was also not satisfying client. At the end of the day, Chalk is the real client who was dissatisfied, and Chalk is the client criticism that is fully unrebutted. As to the affidavits that were submitted from these two other clients, they don't exactly dispute what was said about them. They merely say, well, in general, you know, he was okay, but as to the specific criticisms that were attributed to him, Cuton and Felbinger said about O'Leary, that he didn't seem as engaged, that he wasn't around very much, their declarations don't dispute that. But I think more to Your Honor's point, Ms. Tolan never claimed that she fired O'Leary based on what Cuton or Felbinger said. She said that it was Chalk's criticism and his very disappointing performance at St. Mary's Hospital, among other leadership failings, that led to his removal. So we have no concern about these other two. I don't think that the two declarations from those other two clients creates a material fact at all. And plaintiff had every opportunity to take Chalk deposition, and they didn't. So their testimony about what he said, that he was an empty suit, that he wanted him removed from the account, that he was highly dissatisfied with O'Leary's performance. Whether he was right or wrong, whether he was mistaken in thinking that O'Leary was responsible for best possible, that's not the issue. Under this court's definition of pretext, they have to show not that the employer was mistaken in its judgment, but that they're lying about it. And there's no evidence here that they were lying. The record is crystal clear that these performance problems, client criticisms that ultimately led to the termination, were going on that entire year, 4 months before his termination, that O'Leary himself was very anxious about his job security. Now, why would he be writing emails and expressing concern about his job security and saying, you know, I think she's about to fire me, referring to the CEO, which he says a month before his complaint? Why would he say, I've been disappointing her and complaining to other people about this, if he hadn't in fact been getting negative feedback from the CEO?
Maybe because of all, you know, his complaints, his regarding both sexual and racial discrimination, he realized that everyone was getting angry with him.
But Your Honor, that
you know, Ms. Tolan.
But with all due respect, Your Honor, that turns the chronology on its head. He didn't make the complaint until after he had been criticized, which might lead one to suspect what his motives were. You know, maybe he saw the handwriting on the wall and thought he might wrap himself in the cloak of immunity by making a complaint. I see that I'm out of time, unless the court has further questions.
No.
Thank you very much.
No, you may have two, because we took so much of your time.
Thank
Never
you.
Asked for just one.
Briefly. There's a question, a fact issue, as to whether Tolan was honest about the very disappointing results at St. Mary's. December 8, 2006, she sent an email to all employees congratulating and promoting Travis Marr to vice president, saying, based on your successful engagement at St. Mary's, the financial records and results that were available in December 06 show that St. Mary's was on target, performing well, and she her contemporaneous email said St. Mary's is a great, successful engagement. Why, Judge Adelman, you asked why would they accretive ask O'Leary to leave St. Mary's. Rhonda Miller was a favored employee, and she was rumored to have a sexual relationship with Greg Kazarian, the general counsel. They wanted her in there. They kept her in there. They asked O'Leary to move. O'Leary did raise concerns directly to Rhonda Miller before October 23rd, before he met with Tolan, saying, Miller, you can't treat your employees this way. Miller, plausible inference, credited most favorable to O'Leary that Miller raised these concerns and senior management was protecting her and removing O'Leary.
Well, thank you both for a really well-argued appeal. The court is appreciative. And the case will be taken under advisement.